This is probably the most iconic music from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. It plays all over the place this time of year. Television commercials, shopping malls, but most importantly, on stages decorated with giant pastel sweets. Children sit there looking up at the stage in wonder as the Sugar Plum Fairy comes out in a glistening costume. This is a special moment. And the music tells you everything you need to know about it. The Sugar Plum Fairy's solo is delicate, precise, otherworldly. You can hear that, no distractions, just one dancer in the spotlight with impeccable technique and the kind of stage presence that makes it work. This year, for the first time, the dancer in that spotlight here in Kansas City is Black. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I am excited to introduce Whitney Huell, the Kansas City Ballet's first Black Sugar Plum Fairy. Hi, Whitney.
Hi.
So I'm guessing you're pretty busy right now?
Yes, very busy. We are 3 weeks into our Nutcracker season, and we have one more weekend, and then it's Christmas break.
How does it feel to you to be introduced that way, the first Black Sugar Plum Fairy in Kansas City?
I feel very honored that I have been, you know, given this role and able to perform it. And I feel that it could be very inspiring to, you know, young dancers of color that may want to pursue ballet and possibly be the Sugar Plum Fairy and see someone like themselves on the stage so they know that they can get there.
So let's make sure that everyone understands a few things about the Nutcracker. Just to understand what a big deal this is, first of all, pretty much everyone in the company plays more than one part, and you play two really important roles. You're making history this year as the first Black Sugar Plum Fairy here in town, but you made history last year as the first Black Snow Queen, and you still play both parts.
I do. I still do both Snow Queen and Sugar Plum Fairy was my new role this year. As well.
So, can you explain how this whole like kind of progression from one role to another works and how it is that dancers all play more than one part?
Mm-hmm. So there are several casts in the ballet. We have seven casts this year.
That is amazing.
Yeah, which is great. It's a great opportunity for dancers to, you know, have the opportunity to do more roles. So the casts switch. And so one cast I might be doing Spanish, one cast I might be doing a parent, you know, in the party scene. And then there, my cast five is Snow Queen. And then my cast seven was Sugar Plum.
And there's also the way that kids interact with this that's important. The Nutcracker is a really big deal to kids. There are tons of kids on stage and then tons of kids in the audience, which makes who plays what role, kind of this ladder that you climb if you're a dancer, starting when you're a really little kid and up through adulthood if you become a professional.
Yes. I remember actually when I was in school and we had a field trip and we saw the Nutcracker and I was so excited. And it was exciting for me to actually see children on stage, like in the party scene. And, you know, the version I saw, there were bonbons and it made me really excited to do it. And I was like, I want to do that, you know. So I think the school shows we put on are very important for children to see that and see that, you know, there's children on stage as well as adults and that they could, you know, eventually do something.
And like children that participate. I mean, there's this whole world of rehearsals. Like the performance part of the Nutcracker for people who are in it is a tiny part. The rehearsal aspect of the Nutcracker is this whole world where little kids come together with, for them, their heroes, you know, the professional dancers they see on stage the rest of the year while they're in their seats for the only time, really. That's the biggest time anyway, where they're all working together and kids are sort of at the table the whole way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they rehearse in the beginning by themselves. So when they come with the company dancers, they already know what they're doing. It's just kind of, you know, gelling it together with the company dancers. And I'm always really impressed because they know exactly what they're doing. You know, sometimes since we have so many roles, we are like, oh, where are our kids? Like, you know, especially in the party scene. But they usually know what they're doing. And it's really nice to interact with them. And they're always very sweet.
So when you say that you might inspire someone, there are lots of opportunities for that with this particular ballet.
Yes. I think since, you know, this is my first lead in a production, and I think that would really inspire, you know, a dancer of color, that they could be the lead of a ballet, you know.
I didn't realize this was your mm-hmm. first lead, period.
Yes, I've done principal roles and like soloist roles, but never like the lead of a ballet. This is my first time.
Did you grow up dreaming about being a sugar plum fairy or imagining that that was possible?
Yes, I did. But I think part of me didn't want to like think about that, because what if it didn't happen, like that kind of thing. I was like, you'd see it and be like, oh, that would be really cool to do that, but I don't know if it's going to happen. So that the fact that it has happened has been like a dream come true.
Tell me about your background and your ballet training.
Well, I actually started at a company and school called D. Crump School of Dance in Columbia, South Carolina. And it was actually like a multicultural school. So there were a lot of Black students there, and that's what I was used to. Then when I got more training, I realized, you know, I was more of the minority.
More training, what did that look like? What kind of more training?
I went to the South Carolina Governor School for the Arts and Humanities, which was like a performing arts high school. And that's where I kind of really cleaned up my technique and everything and realized I wanted to dance professionally. I did summer programs as well in the summer. I went to Boston Ballet Summer Program and Dance Theater of Harlem Summer Program, which was really fulfilling for me. And then I went to Indiana University in their ballet program for 3 years. I graduated in 3 years, and I really wanted to join a company, and I got into Ballet West 2 in Salt Lake City, Utah. And then I spent 2 seasons in the second company, and then I got into the full company. I was there for 5 years, and then I really wanted to move somewhere where there was more diversity, somewhere where I felt like I would fit in a little better, and a city that I think would welcome me more. And I got into Kansas City Ballet, and it has been a great fit, and it was probably one of the best decisions that I've made thus far in my career.
I want to take some time with a couple of the steps along that way that you've just touched upon. Mm-hmm. One step being your decision to go to a performing arts high school. That's a huge leap of faith.
Yes, actually, I'm really close with my mom, and a lot of people were like, she's going to go and live at a school by herself. Like, I can't believe she's going to do that, because, you know, everybody was like, you're going to leave your mom, you know, but I was all for it. I was like, I get to dance all day and stay there. And so that was
It takes confidence in the possibilities ahead, though, in a dance career to do something like that.
At the time, I just wanted to dance. And so I wasn't really thinking about the future, really. I was just thinking about the present. And that's why I went for it. And it was a great experience. I had great teachers, and they really pushed me to, you know, a level that I hadn't been pushed before.
But then your realization that you were, as you put it, a minority in the world of classical ballet. Can you talk about that realization and how you felt it and how it affected you?
I think it, you know, especially when I would go to summer programs, like when I went to Boston Ballet, I think I was one of the only African-American females in the summer program. And in my level, I was the only one. And so I was like, oh, wow, like, because at other places there were, you know, 2 or 3, you know.
And I should explain, you know, with ballet training, the summer programs, that's mm-hmm. where students from all over the country, these schools kind of go through a rigorous audition process all over the country and take who they consider to be the best students. And so that's a big deal that you were doing these things.
Right. I actually didn't even know about these summer programs until I went to Governor School. And then actually some of my friends were like, you should, you know, go to a summer program. And so then I would start auditioning. We'd, you know, carpool and go to those auditions together. And you send in your picture or whatever, and they, you know, send you a letter back whether you got in or not. And
you wear a number.
You wear a number. It's really frustrating, actually. But, yeah, I went to Boston Ballet that summer, and it was, yeah, I was the minority, but I felt like I got so much out of it. And it didn't really matter that I looked different. I was still learning the same things everyone else was learning.
So it was just a realization that you filed away?
Right, yeah. It wasn't until later in my career where I felt like sometimes it was a bit of a hindrance for me. Like, I felt like I could dance just as well as the other dancers in the room. And I'm like, why isn't this person looking at me? Why do I feel overlooked? Why, you know? And so I began to be like, well, is it because I'm black? Like, do they not think I can do it, you know? And so that has been tough. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot, but it has happened in the past, and it's very hurtful. But, you know, luckily I've, you know, kind of broken that chain, and I feel like I've been getting opportunities that everyone else gets as well.
Is there anything you've ever done sort of intentionally as in an attempt to break that chain, or just you've stuck it out?
I've stuck it out, definitely, but I've tried to work harder. Like, when I've been in those situations, I've tried not to let my mind take over and get upset and not try anymore. I still try, you know, like, yeah, this person isn't interested, but I'm still going to do my best and, you know, dance as well as I can, you know, do my best.
And so you said that coming to Kansas City was in part motivated by a desire to be in a more diverse community, and that you have found it that way. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes. In Salt Lake, it's not the most diverse city or company. I mean, they have a lot of, you know, dancers of color now. But when I moved there, I think I was the only dancer of color in the company at the time. And also, when we would go to, you know, outreach things, there would be very few children of color in schools. You know, and so I started to feel that I wanted to be able to reach out to people that looked like myself, that when I was young and I saw, you know, a dancer of color on stage, and that's what drove me, really, you know, and also wanting a change drove me to audition. And ultimately, I ended up here, and I feel very happy with my decision.
You know, when it comes to the Nutcracker, I wonder if you think, like, the European origins of this story have made the diverse representations kind of a complicated thing. Like, the opening scene that you've referenced, the party scene, that's a scene where the characters are supposed to be upper-class Germans in some other time period having a very fancy Christmas party where people waltz for fun. Do you think that part of, like, the basis for that story is maybe why it's taken so long, or do you think it's something else?
I think, yeah, that's probably what it is. Where it originated is definitely what they're trying to stick to, or what has, you know, been the thing that they stick to. But I also think that, you know, people are trying to branch out. I saw the Nutcracker in the Four Realms movie, and, you know, Drosselmeyer was played by Morgan Freeman, who's black, you know, and I saw a lot of diversity. The Nutcracker Prince was black. So I was really excited to see that and see how they're, you know, breaking that up. And, you know, not everybody has to look the same.
Yeah, the music doesn't dictate what people look like at a party.
Exactly.
It's interesting. You know, what would you say is the meaning of the Sugar Plum Fairy? You've said that she's the lead. It's interesting because plot-wise, her role is kind of hard to pin down.
Right. Clara, you know, goes to the Land of Sweets with the Nutcracker, and Drosselmeyer's around as well.
That's and her uncle, who's kind of a weird magician.
Yeah, exactly. And she goes to this Land of Sweets, and she's kind of like, say, like the queen of this land. You know, and she basically, you know, brings out all the divertissements, which are like Spanish chocolate, Arabian coffee, all that. She is the one that kind of orchestrates everything for Clara. And so I'd say her role is more of just this magical fairy that is just there for Clara and, you know, shows her the land.
Do you think of her as maybe like Clara's adult mirror image in this alternate magical reality?
I think that could be a one way of looking at it. I haven't exactly really thought about it in that way. But now that you're saying that, I think that could be a huge possibility. And I think some versions of the Nutcracker, that is the case. That Clara becomes like the Sugar Plum Fairy.
What has it been like for you from getting the part to learning the choreography to now performing?
It's been great. I have to admit, I was really surprised when I was learning it. And it challenged me in a way I haven't been challenged in a long time. The physicality of it all and doing so much dancing all at once.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, the pas de deux and the variation and the coda are about 13 or 14 minutes long. So it's a long time to be on stage dancing, like it's consecutively, like at the same, you know. And so when I remember I ran the pas the first time in the studio.
That's shorthand for the pas de deux.
Yeah, for the pas de deux. I was like, oh my goodness, I haven't felt this tired in years, you know, because I haven't been doing those kind of roles probably since high school. And it felt so good. Like, it was hard. My legs were burning. My feet were burning. But it was like being alive. It was just so magical. And I was so excited to do it again, you know.
I mentioned earlier that this is, you know, this is a beautiful role. It is light. It is airy. But I have never danced it. But I have danced. So when I look at what people are doing in this role, it has to be grueling, especially the point work piece of it, like what is happening to your feet. I feel like the Sugar Plum Fairy's choreography almost has a dare in it. Like, let's see if she can do this. It's that unforgiving.
Right. I remember when we were first learning it, I was like, man, my toes. I've been up on my toes this whole time. There's not a whole lot of, you know, up on your toes and then back down or jumping around. You're pretty much on this left leg or this left foot on point for a long time. And it was something I had to really get used to and kind of pace myself in the pas de deux. That was definitely a challenge.
Do you think that this is like a rite of passage or just sort of a symbol of having arrived in this really special place in the ballet world to be the Sugar Plum Fairy?
Oh, definitely. I think this is a very iconic role and a role that many dancers dream of doing, myself included. And
did I hear that you had a Christmas ornament?
Yes, I did.
Sort of predicted this almost.
My aunt sent me a little Sugar Plum Fairy, and it's a black Sugar Plum Fairy. And it was on my tree, and it happened. So I'm really, maybe it was like a foreshadowing or something.
What do you hope will come of this, like, quote-unquote first, which you are now part of, first black Sugar Plum Fairy in Kansas City's Nutcracker?
I hope that, you know, this is just the start of the things that I'll get to do in the future, continue to be pushed and continue to get opportunities that will push me as an artist.
Whitney Hewell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Whitney is making local history, dancing the part of Sugar Plum Fairy in this year's Nutcracker with the Kansas City Ballet. It runs through Sunday. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR Central Standard. When we come back, we'll check in on an app being piloted here in town. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're catching up with Reggie Gray. We spoke with him earlier this year about an app he's piloting here called Black Privilege. The idea is to connect consumers who want to support Black-owned businesses with those businesses. The app's got national ambitions, but they're testing the waters here. They launched in May, and as we think back on new projects that launched in 2018, this one stands out. We're kind of curious about how it's going. Reggie Gray with Black Privilege, welcome back, and good morning.
Good morning, good morning. And first of all, Gene, I just want to say I'm so honored and humbled to be back sitting in this chair with the legendary Gina.
Oh, man. I'm just going to keep going.
Gotcha.
So how is it going, though? How is this app going so far?
Oh, this has just been a phenomenal journey. And Kansas City is so phenomenal. It's a great test market, but this city is progressive beyond belief. I don't just mean with the black community, I mean with everyone.
You know, that's not our reputation.
Mm-hmm. Surely not. And before we even decided to choose on Kansas City, that's all of the negative energy we were getting from people nationally and some locally is that Kansas City isn't progressive enough. It's too conservative. Missouri and Kansas. Are there black businesses? Are black folk progressive there? And our research has showed that the city was ready for this. But Gene, if I can real quickly, I just want to pay homage to an organization called KC Black United Front. They're not our partners, but they're an organization that is actually one of the first in the country to launch a mobile app similar to what we're doing. And they're out of Kansas City. So I just wanted to take 1 second just to say that KC Black United Front and other phenomenal organizations have helped pave the way for what we're doing now.
Okay, I want to hear more about that, but remind us why Kansas City was chosen to pilot Black Privilege, and then we'll talk more about like what it is and how it's gone.
Awesome. Well, Kansas City, there were probably about 5 or 6 different markets we had to choose from. And as you can imagine, most people said Atlanta was where we needed to be. But to pilot technology, we were not going to go to Atlanta for that.
And you say that like I should understand why, but I don't.
Atlanta is like the Black Mecca. Atlanta is where, especially if you're talking about anything in the urban field, hip-hop, music, clothing, Atlanta is where you want to be. So many of our local artists from Kansas City have relocated to Atlanta or other markets, a Dallas, a Houston, a LA. Those are markets that are more progressive, more welcoming, and have a much larger African-American population.
But why would you not want to start something out there?
Well, if I can be frank, number one, with bigger markets means you have to spend more money. So that's number one. Number two, we wanted a market that we could have a better gauge on. And Kansas City is a wonderful market to test new startups and new ideas. And let's just be honest, Kansas City is probably one of the top entrepreneurial startup markets in the country, hands down.
You're not just saying that to make us feel good?
Well, I'm not from here, but I love Kansas City. I claim the city now. But yes, being here for about a decade, I'm just blown away with the plethora of resources that this city provides.
So what are you learning from the Kansas City, if I may call it an experiment, mm-hmm. What the Kansas City experiment so far? Any surprises?
One big surprise is when we first launched, we wanted to be careful because we are an inclusive organization. So we didn't know how the non-Black population was going to view this. And to our surprise, this movement has been embraced by so many non-Black, and I want to call them progressive thinkers, who get it.
Can you explain how, as you're putting it, non-Black progressive thinkers have connected with this app? Like, what is it that they are using it for?
Okay. One thing is folk who understand the importance of circulating their dollars in different communities. Let me say this first of all. This is not an only by Black movement. What this is change the way you think about spending and investing your money. So we're not saying, hey, spend all of your money in the Black community. We're saying, hey, why don't you find one Black business you like and support them once a month, once a quarter. Mobile app user we have that just stood out is a Jewish gentleman out of Johnson County. And he downloaded the app probably in our first month. He did a beautiful post about how his community sticks together and they invest in their own and they build each other up. And how he loved the spirit of the Black Privilege movement. That's the only post he sent. But every month he checks in to, I guess, one of his favorite restaurants, which is an African restaurant in Johnson County. And he checks in once a month. And that's the main thing we wanted, was just people to embrace supporting others. And more so even for my own people. You know, some people know the numbers. The Black dollar is powerful, $1.3 trillion nationally. But us, Black people, we only spend 2% back into our own communities. That's us.
So the idea is that if people have a way of knowing how to sort of intentionally access Black-owned businesses, that there are people who would want to do it. They just like need that point of connection.
Absolutely. And another thing that our app does that separates from any others that may be similar is we are a community, meaning that people can post in the live feed, but they can also research resources. So it's much more than just black-owned businesses. It's also resources. So if someone has a substance abuse problem, there are different resources that they can contact. If someone wants to be an entrepreneur, there are different resources. And any nonprofit organization can join the mobile application. Doesn't have to be a black founder.
So you've shared some that one of your surprises was, at least one of your surprises was really positive, that there was a non-black audience for this that would support it and get excited and get involved. What have been some challenges that you've discovered? I mean, one thing that I've been interested in hearing about are whether there are challenges facing black-owned businesses that you need more than an app to solve, like barriers that you're going to come up against whether you have this app and this knowledge or not.
Gina, you couldn't be more correct. First of all, one of the biggest challenges is black-owned businesses and entrepreneurs, they need mentors. And that's something that our app cannot do. Now, we can point users to resources that provide mentorship, but that we can't do. Also, we don't have the content structure in place yet to where users can be able to look at those who look like them, representation, but speaking about their entrepreneurial successes. So really, we're a platform, but we don't provide everything to keep users thoroughly engaged and to get them all the information they need. And Gina, let me also add, yes, this is technology. And with technology means problems, means glitches, means issues. We launched at the end of May, and June was probably the most stressful month this year because we're learning the technology. People were having problems logging in. A lot of folk, we realized, did not want to sign up. So we found out we were on thousands of phones that never signed up, meaning they never got inside of the app.
Wait, what do you mean?
Well, in order, when you download our app, you have to sign up, similar to how Facebook is, but we're not Facebook. But you have to sign up, meaning you have to give your name, your email address. It probably is about a 1 to 2 minute process. But nowadays, we're in a society where people don't want to have to take a minute or two. They want to get right in, browse, and experience. And if you make them have to jump through hurdles, they are done. And we've experienced some of that.
So this is, I'm speaking with Reggie Gray, and he's with us from the Black Privilege app, which launched in Kansas City this May. And he's been telling us what he's learned so far. And this is a national project. They're basing some of their decision on whether to go national on what happens here. What is that looking like? Is it like, hey, this is something that can go elsewhere, or has Kansas City not put the proof in the pudding or whatever?
As far as we're concerned, we've already proven the concept in Kansas City. In the first 6 months, we have over 8,000 downloads, over 700 black-owned businesses in over 20 different categories, and hundreds of resources added. But what we have learned is that HBCUs, that's historically black colleges and universities, for us to really go national and be successful, HBCUs are going to have to be the foundation, and we're going to have make major changes to the app to really scale.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the truth is this. Where can you find the most educated, progressive, and free-thinking African-Americans at one place? HBCUs. I'm a graduate of Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's one place where you can go and sit in front of 7 to 10,000 18 to 23-year-olds that are not scared to try new things and that are the future of our country. So that's what we learned in Kansas City, because even though I think there's an HBCU outside of the market, there's not one directly in Kansas City.
So does that mean that you have come up against not finding enough people in that age group, like a big enough audience in that age group willing to, as you said, try new things, you know?
Yeah, and I will take some of the responsibility myself, because when we first launched, we launched before the mobile app was done. So our biggest thing when we launched was, let's create a movement. Let's get people excited about this. And we were successful. But after we launched the app, you can ask a lot of people when they hear Black Privilege, majority don't even know we have an app. They'll say, wow, we love what Black Privilege does. They feature businesses and organizations, and they don't even have the app. So I'll take responsibility that our messaging has to be better. And let me just say this for anyone else out there who may think about doing an app. Those who have never been a part of the process, everyone thinks it is, oh, I have a great idea. It's going to scale. It's going to be a $1 billion company. A successful mobile app is the equivalent of making it to the NBA. It's the most competitive field, and if you do not have the funds to continue building, updating, making changes, the team that we partnered with, they've already spent an additional $15,000 after we launched the app because we're constantly learning. So just some advice that this isn't as easy as most people think, and the majority will fail. Statistics show that.
Wait, it sounds like, from your experience, the movement and message piece of it might be taking off more than the app itself.
See, that's why I love Gina, because I wasn't even thinking like that. But Gina, you are correct. You're correct. But to those in other markets, that's encouraging. And for us to be in this market and have the non-Black support we've had as well is encouraging, because that shows that our messaging is at least open to everyone, or at least we try our best, because we always say we love everyone. We support all businesses, but there are things in our community that we do have to do better.
So speaking of that, one of the things that came up last time we spoke was that the business owner who came on, she was looking for other Black professionals to hire as she needed various services. And she realized that she was missing the networking opportunities that would introduce her to, like, that would allow her to do what she was asking people to do for her. She wanted to support Black entrepreneurs, and she was having trouble identifying people in her own community to support. Has that helped? I mean, has the app helped with that? Or is that another example of something where you need more than an app?
I will admit that our future plans, the technology will do better in assisting with that. But I do have to just give a quick shout out to some of our partners who I think will assist in bridging that gap. We recently partnered with the Heartland Black Chamber of Commerce. They're under new leadership, have a phenomenal new board. We're also partnering with the Black Archives, Porterhouse KC, which is a young organization that does monthly events, also KC SourceLink and Visit KC. So we're working with all of these phenomenal organizations and groups so we can be able to provide better events to bring like-minded professionals and entrepreneurial minds together.
I understand that your new plan is to set up like a technology hub, almost a community center type space on the east side. Why is that?
Well, as many of us know, or maybe don't know, the urban core, and specifically the east side, is a technology desert. And there are not many places where you can go and be able to learn about technology. But before I get to that, I do have to give a shout out to Urban Tech, Urban TEC. That is a phenomenal organization that is in urban schools that is already teaching kids. Also, Eastside Collaborative, which was on the east side and set up a co-working space. So there are already organizations trying it. But yes, the big vision is for us to take over an entire block and develop from the ground up and be a state-of-the-art tech center open for the entire community. But Gina, you know, like me, that's going to be millions of dollars. And millions of dollars, that price tag, that doesn't scare us. But we're in year one, about to finish year one. So we're ambitious, but we still have a lot of networking and relationships to build.
So plan might be, it's more dream than plan at this point?
Oh, well, brother stays dreaming, Gina, but I'll say at least a 3 to 5 year plan slash dream.
So we have a caller who has been sort of intrigued by what you've been saying, and Dwight and KCK would like to talk to you. Okay. Hi, Dwight.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good.
My question is, you keep seeing free thinkers or Black people are freaking. Are you talking about atheists or skeptical people? And also, are you trying to reach other people of color? Because I'm Mexican myself, and are you specifically wanting just Black folk?
Okay, so two-parter here. One is, what do you mean by free thinkers?
Great question, Dwight, and thank you for calling in. Dwight, first of all, we do not judge anyone. So it doesn't matter if you're Christian, atheist, heterosexual, homosexual, we don't care. And we've even lost supporters because of that. Because so if someone wants to judge other folk in regards to that matter, then maybe this platform isn't for you.
Wait. You've lost supporters because of that?
Yes. I've had multiple people inbox us. And one gentleman asked, do we support homosexuals? And I said, we love all people. We don't judge anyone. And our platform is open to anyone. And the person said, thank you. I will be deleting the app off my phone.
Wow.
Yep. And I said, thank you and have a great day.
So, is that hard for you to do or no?
No, because, and this is all out of love, all out of love. And Dwight, in regards to your last question, the founder of this organization did create this movement for African-Americans, meaning African-American run businesses or businesses that at least have 1% African-American in them or ownership. But I will say this, there are a few non-Black businesses actually on the app, and those are businesses that are deep in the African-American community and support. Dwight, let me bring up one more thing. My wife is Mexican, and she also is a big supporter of Black privilege. Her father owns a Mexican restaurant in Lee Summit, and I circulate my money consistently in the Hispanic community.
It sounds like you're saying maybe other communities need this kind of platform as well.
Well, a lot of them already do better than we do, unfortunately.
Well, Reggie Gray, with Black Privilege here in Kansas City, thanks so much and keep us posted.
Thank you so much, Gina.
The Black Privilege app is being piloted in Kansas City. It launched in May. And next, how about some tasty French cookies? There's a macaron pop-up this Saturday, Meet the Baker, on KCUR's Central Standard. When a local, self-taught baker by the name of J.C. Gregg first heard about the Great American Baking Show, a reality show for bakers, he was with a friend.
I looked at her and I said, you know, I'm going to be on that show.
He was right. Technically, he was on that show. Or he was filmed for a season anyway. The season never ran. There was a whole scandal involving one of the judges. But J.C. has made a really big point of saying the experience was still amazing. It introduced him to people who shared his passion. It also catapulted him onto the food scene here in town. His specialty? The pretty little jewel-colored French cookies known as macarons. And yes, that is how you say it. He's hosting a macaron pop-up this Saturday in Overland Park. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Let's revisit our conversation about baking with J.C. Gregg.
I grew up on a farm. And my mother used to always bake, and there were six of us kids, so there were always pastries, always cakes. And then my mother passed away and in 2001, and in her honor, I decided to take that and continue on with my love of art and then my love of, and passion of baking. And I combined the two and started coming up with some pretty fun, unique items.
What had been your own personal experience in the kitchen before that?
Did a lot of cooking. I also cook, surprisingly enough. I've just kind of gravitated more towards baking. I did bake occasionally. I did, back in the early 2000s, I did get into the gastro, you know, all of the chemicals and things like that when Top Chef came out, which was really fun. And I continued that. But
where it would be like a bite of something that had like a chemical equation behind it.
Right. I would take sodium alginate and mix that with a liqueur and dip it in calcium or sodium chloride, and it would create little balls of liquor. And I would then put that on a mousse.
Did it taste good? Because those descriptions, like when you say what that is, it sounds gross.
Well, it does sound gross, but it is really good. You really can't taste it. It just created a tiny little membrane around whatever substance you were jellifying. It was really good. It was
jellifying.
Yeah, right. Yeah, kind of. But it was really good, and it kind of gave a little pop as it was eaten. It was really good.
And so you really, though, got into baking as a tribute to your mom.
I did. Yes, I did. My mom was my heart, and I took basically her mayonnaise cake that I had growing up, and I converted that into a more modern, I used an organic substance.
Instead of like Hellman's?
No, I still used Hellman's, but I used a natural organic emulsifier and changed the structure of the cake. And it's a monosodium, it's MGS. That's what I...
So you used the molecular baking techniques to transform a sort of like farmhouse mayonnaise cake?
I did. I took it from something that was extremely light and airy to more of a dense, moist, and a better mouthfeel for me personally.
How do you fit in your baking? I mean, you have a day job at Costco, but it is not as a baker.
No, it is not as a baker. I'm one of the auditor for Costco. I do accounting and research and purchases to sales ratios. But what I do is I'm fortunate in that I don't require a lot of sleep. So I typically go to bed about 10:30 every night and get up at 2:30 every morning. And when I get up, I have my shower, my coffee, and I'm in the kitchen just working with different pastry creams or buttercreams and changing things up a little bit in anticipation for the next pastry that I want to create.
Do you think the middle of the night vibe kind of inspires you in a particular way?
It does. And I tell you, what happens is when everything kind of shuts down around 9 o'clock and all of the energy signals have slowed down, that's when I start to rev up. That's when I feel more energetic and more creative and more passionate about what I'm doing.
And you have this social media presence where you share the tasty things that you accidentally made.
Yeah, that's so fun. I started that about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Oh, I accidentally made 400 French macarons last night. So yeah.
Whoops.
I know, right? And people are like, well, I wish I was so accident prone, you know.
Yeah. Okay, but what are some of the recipes that you have been really excited about making?
I would say the French recipes that I have are second to none, and they're just building blocks for me. Yeah, I take the traditional Saint-Honoré, the Paris Brest, the Madeleines, and the macarons, but I kind of think a little bit outside of the box sometimes with flavor profiles and creativity, and I take it to a different level. I impart me in that pastry, and whomever I'm baking for, I want to know their likes, their dislikes, where they've traveled, what they've eaten, their favorite colors, their favorite flavors, their joys, their sorrows, and I will create something just for that person.
Oh, it's about the person. I mean, you make things for particular eaters?
Absolutely. And I typically will not create the same thing twice, because that takes away from that gift that I'm able to give of myself to the person that's receiving it.
But then like 400 macarons.
The 400 macarons would typically be for a charity event, which is very...
So not just someone who likes to eat a lot.
No. Well, that would be fun, but I typically do charity events and don't do a lot of orders on the side. I like to be able to share and give back to the community in any way I can. And if I can do this and somebody can raise money because of it, then I'm all for it.
Well, so tell me about someone who inspired you to make something that you never would have come up with if not for that person as your muse.
Actually, the trip to London inspired me. It changed a perspective within me. That trip wasn't just about me baking. It was a journey that I had to have. And when I came back, I was asked to speak at Johnson County Community College for a group of people. And I was able to pour myself for one of the first times into a pastry that was about me. And what inspires me is everyone around me, their happiness and their joys, their sorrows. I just like to give back and have that represented in my food.
You are famous for your macaron. And what I like about macaron in particular is not just that I get to be snooty with my French accent, but also how pretty they are.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's really fun. Macarons have really, for some reason, become kind of a signature for me. Even though I do so many other things, I can take a macaron and I can turn it into a piece of toast by taking bread and putting it in the toaster and then cooking it in the oven and then grating it and then putting that in the macaron shell and do a peanut butter layer in between.
Whoa.
That's my guilty pleasure, is a piece of peanut butter toast every night. And I created this macaron for me, which I typically don't do. So I just kind of come up with some pretty cool flavors and add stuff in when I can. I've many failures, but I have a lot of successes.
Tell me about another success besides the peanut butter toast-inspired macaron.
One of the things that I've recently done is I have taken a macaron and elongated it and did a pâte à choux and made an éclair. I then took several types of creams and built inside the éclair, and then I topped it with the macaron. And then I was able to adorn and use that flatness from the macaron and put passion fruit gelée on top with crisp pearls. And it was just a beautiful, delicious mouth bite.
How do you make macaron? I mean, we don't need the exact measurement instructions or anything like that, but just the overview of the steps.
The macaron is, my macaron is a true French macaron. I do tant for tant, which means equal parts of everything. I do the same amount of egg whites to granulated sugar to powdered sugar to almond meal. Making a French meringue, in my case, or an Italian meringue, you whip your, make a meringue, and then you mix your almond meal and powdered sugar. At that point is where the magic happens. When you introduce the meal to the meringue, you have to be very gentle so you don't deflate all of the egg white, but you have to deflate some of it. If you over deflate, it goes flat. If you under, it bursts out the top. So it's a very structured way of making. It's fun. It's really fun.
Why do you think French pastries are like the gold standard for pastries worldwide?
Well, I can only say, dating back to the 1600s, when puff pastry was invented, everything is so light and ethereal, whereas here we have gone to heavy laden sugar products that are thick and dense. In the French pastries, it's copious amounts of butter and fat, yes, but it's also very light on the palate, and you can change so many aspects of it, and it's a different mouthfeel. It's just an overall experience, whereas here we tend to have cake. But a pastry is more than
cake
just...
cake in different shapes.
Yes,
with a hole in the middle.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly right. A donut or, it's a bundt cake. Right. But you can do so much with the French basics that I think that is basically the gold standard of all pastries.
Do we have a pretty good selection to choose from? Or are there French pastries that you wish we could find more easily in Kansas City?
I can honestly say I don't go out for pastries much.
Well, why would you? I before we complete our conversation, I just have to say you have brought in something that is beautiful. I don't know what it is. Can you tell me about it?
Absolutely. This is called a Saint Honoré. It was named after the patron saint of baking, and it was created in the Chabouste factory in France in 1847. It's a puff pastry base. And then around that, I have a pâte à choux. They bake together. So
what is a pâte à choux?
A pâte à choux is the dough in which cream puffs are made of.
Gotcha.
So I piped that around the edge of the puff pastry, baked it together. I made a praline paste and mixed that with a pastry cream.
J.C. Gregg joined us for that interview in April. He's hosting a macaron pop-up at the Olive Tree in Overland Park. Park this Saturday at 3. He's selling treats by the dozen, but I would consider showing up early because his Facebook event page notes that the last time he did this, he sold out in an hour. And our time is up for this morning's show. You can grab links to anything you heard today at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We archive all our past shows there, so check them out. Tomorrow, our bibliophiles are stopping by to recommend the best nonfiction of the year. What did you read? What we should we be running out to grab a copy? Let's trade book reviews tomorrow at 10. Or you can start now on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, intern Sophia Gillespie, and Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.